Charlie, how you doing, buddy?
Very well. How are you?
I'm all right. My knee's kind of fucked up. The story's not good. It is NCSA related in a weird way. I got hurt during my second year stage combat demonstration, like when they do the board breaking shit. I did that. And during my first fight, I like did a move and didn't do it right because I'm up here, man. I'm one of these guys. I'm not one of these guys. Yeah. And but, you know, drama school, got to do a lot of these guys stuff. So I'm doing the these guys stuff. Yeah. You know, neck down shit. Not my area. And we're doing the unarmed fight. I'm supposed to like jump over like a sweep leg kick thing. And I did it and I landed wrong. And the knee just goes. And I didn't walk for like a month almost. I had to leave immediately and go to Atlanta.
Damn.
Because I was working at Georgia Shakespeare for the summer. Mm-hmm. And so just no healthcare. A cane from CVS or whatever it was at the time was my remedy. And over the years, I keep having issues every now and then where it kind of slips. And this was the only one since then that took me out for like weeks. So it's kind of fun that it's my 10-year college anniversary and I'm as in pain as I was while I was there.
When you first started that story, I was wondering what situation you were in that you had to break a board in now. Yeah, I was like, what did you do? Did he have to do karate chops or?
I'm working on my taekwondo, finally picking it up after second grade. I thought, let's get back to it. It's not true.
Oh.
I gotta be careful too, because I'm not that sarcastic or sardonic with people on this podcast in comparison to other things. So I have to
I'm
watch
very
myself.
Dry.
I fucking love it, dude. It's so up my alley, and I gotta shift into that gear.
No one's gonna take this podcast seriously.
We have more obvious conversations here. Let's do that though. We'll do some housekeeping stuff as always at the Elephants. Context of how I know you. Mm-hmm. I don't at all, really. We met really briefly at an alumni thing that John Bowers put together. But man, it was like really fast. I kind of got there early. You kind of got there a little bit later. We didn't really talk or anything like that. You also, I think hit me up in the DMs of the podcast on Instagram. And we kind of just talked about you're enjoying the show and stuff like that. And I want to say that too, to as many people as will listen to it, hit us up, like say something about the show. If you are watching, if you're listening or whatever, not everyone, and I've mentioned this before, a lot of guests, I'm like, oh, you hit up the DMs. Almost nobody asked to be on the show. He didn't. Most people don't. They're not like, hey, can I get an interview? They just reach out and say, hey, I enjoy the show. I like it. Thanks for making it. That usually leads to some sort of back and forth conversation where, of course, I'm like, well, you're qualified. Come on the show. And the other reason I'm really excited to talk to you is... you graduated very recently. Yeah. I haven't had as many recent grads on. We kind of talked about this at alumni thing. And in general, you're one of the few classes, hopefully ever, that will have to tell the story of being there during COVID, graduating during COVID, all that kind of stuff. And what that experience was like. Let's start at the beginning and we'll kind of work our way through. My only stock question, Charlie, which is where are you from, buddy?
Charlotte.
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Not even gonna say where, what state, Charlotte.
The one, the only.
Yeah.
Born and raised?
Yeah.
What is the family doing in Charlotte when Charlie is small? Are we, what are we doing for work? What's the unit like, siblings, stuff like that?
Yeah, they left South Carolina, which is like the lesser place, you know? South Carolina is viewed as
shots
like-
shots fired.
North Carolina and South Carolina, they see each other a certain way.
That's
North Carolina
true.
Was always viewed as more affluent, progressive, liberal, had better infrastructure. Like
if you're there,
like
if you're in South Carolina, it's seen as up its own ass.
South Carolina viewed it that way, through at least according to my parents, inferiority towards Charlotte, and then North Carolina views. I know it's very strange, but this is like the conversations people would have growing up. And then Charlotte is kind of like a micro Atlanta kind of.
It really is.
Became one. A metro center. So a lot of people who like. Yeah, which Winston hasn't really grown to that state yet.
I think it's important, too. We have a lot of listeners, I think, that kind of land in the like 05, 2015 range. That's like a lot of the people that we've had on the show and then a lot of people listening.
Right. So, but in my childhood, Charlotte was growing.
Exactly. That's what I was going to point out.
Prior. Yeah.
Exactly. It wasn't, well, first of all, Atlanta wasn't Atlanta even when we were at school, because when you were younger and when, like, when I was even thinking about going to school, not quite there yet, North Carolina was, you have to at least know about this if you don't remember, the film thing. The incentive, the tax incentive.
That, so that was the 1990s when these fabulous movies came out. The Kevin Williamson movies.
And early 2000s,
Scream,
too.
I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Right.
So yeah, these amazing horror movies come out, and you also had the teen stuff like Dawson's Creek.
Right, One
so
Tree Hill,
you had,
Wilmington.
And that was all overlapping in terms of the creatives who were making those things.
Right.
So you had teen horror, teen soaps coming out, like truly some of the most like influential stuff to happen in the culture back when. I must say the 90s just had a different je ne sais quoi to it when things were just like, you know, they were different. And then I think Hunger Games was the last thing. But yeah, you won't hear the end of how they killed film in Charlotte, and the HB2 bill, which was the transgender bathroom bill, was a huge point of contention.
Kind of the icing on the cake for, could we get this back? Oh, no, we can't. It was like the nail in the coffin
exactly.
there.
So it chose, the city chose sports over the arts.
Right.
They have a very robust sports economy. A very robust economy in general, but they chose NASCAR, basketball, hockey, football, of course, Carolina Panthers. That's South Carolina and North Carolina's football team.
Right.
It's huge. They just chose sports over the arts. And that's also kind of me as a kid, as a child. I was like, literally dabbled in drama, maybe, or like ballet for like 2 seconds. And I was like, nope, like I'm going to do like a jock. So
you were like a jock kid. What was your sport?
Yeah. Swimming.
Swimming.
But I had to play
kid.
It all lacrosse. And
got
it's not very interesting. They made me play all the sports. And then I did swimming.
What are the parents doing for work that goes from South to North Carolina?
My mom worked at a opioid pharmaceutical manufacturing factory.
That's kind of a cool thing to be a part of at that time.
Yep. And that was also happening at the time. No one knew it was going to happen.
Right,
and then
course.
Now we have, I think, the biggest epidemic facing our time. I think the opioid thing.
Yeah.
And my dad didn't go to college. Went to an, he works in IT.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Siblings?
So he went with the tech boom, which also
right,
crested
of course,
from the 90s
also
to the
part
2000s.
Of Charlotte
you know.
Blowing up. And I also think people in North Carolina don't realize how big Bank of America makes Charlotte, how big of a deal it
so
makes it on the
for
East
all
Coast.
Them and these capacities. And
so many people who, I mean, if you live in Charlotte, you know, but if you don't, and I know plenty of people who went to School of Arts for 4 whole years and never realized that that was what was there. Because again, the city was just kind of smaller.
After 9/11 in 2001, they needed more banking centers. If they just put it all in one place, something like that happened.
So
the banks realized they needed multiple financial centers. So Charlotte became one of the financial centers.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So what's the family unit like as far as like siblings and stuff like that? Are you close with other family?
My sister was into drama. She was into the arts.
You have one sister.
One sister.
Got it.
Yeah.
Younger or older?
Older. Big sister. So I got away with everything.
Of
I was
course.
Little brother. And
babies.
Then she would always tell me, she like went down a very like practical, like lucrative path. And she always told me, she was like, I feel so jealous of you. You got to be gay and go to art school. I never got to do all that, but you're the little brother. You don't have to meet any of the standards. So.
What is practical and lucrative for her?
She's always been really good at, she turned her theater skills and her love of being on a stage and in front of all that stuff. She realized she wasn't going to do that forever. So she turned that into, first of all, teaching. So she was an elementary school teaching major or middle. And then she took that love of being in front of people into giving these presentations and
she's a public speaker.
Talks. Well, she's like a manager at like a really big tech company.
Oh, cool.
And so something about that world is you have to have perfect poise and the ability to give these slideshow PowerPoints in front of all these companies that you're consulting for and stuff. So
you strike me as someone, you say you dabbled a little in drama and ballet. What did that look like? How long did you try each one? Did you do them at the same time or?
One class. It was one class. I had to do a jazz dance class. It wasn't even like phenomenal.
What year? Like what year in your schooling?
I was like six, 7 years old, maybe elementary school.
Oh, young.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I was like, I got to do the boy stuff. I got to like do boy sports and stuff very quickly. But when I was doing that, interestingly, I took a jazz class with a guy who went on to become a really good football player. He was my other like boy doing the jazz class. We're the only two boys. And now he's a very cool screenwriter living in Los Angeles who like went from there to sports to back to the arts.
I am fascinated by this man because we'll compare a little bit of our journeys here because I think this is very interesting how this happens. So, and people who listen to the show know, I've mentioned it before, I'm bisexual. I didn't really engage with it until I was much, much older. So I kind of took like heterosexuality for granted for a really long time, despite thoughts and feelings. And let's be fair, what everyone called me on the football team. But I found...
What were you on the football team?
I was tight end, but I was referring to all the slurs that got slung at me. I grew up in Texas.
I was like, obviously, we all got called slurs, Rob. Yeah. It was the... Now, they call them slurs now. What are we talking about?
It's true.
It's not fun being gay in high school, even though.
No, it's not.
I mean gay as an umbrella. You know?
But you're right, and I understand what you mean. But I'm curious about what you said. You said you're very young. You try this kind of artsy stuff and you're like, I got to go do the boy stuff. Is that attraction to boys as you come into that awareness? Or is that literally like you feel compelled to engage in more masculine activities because it feels like what you like?
Well, Rob, there's a, you're always around other boys in Speedos and you're also getting like jock straps, like slammed into your face on the lacrosse field and the 10 person scram, you know? So,
That's what I'm saying,
you
dude, it could be both.
You know that. But the attraction to boys, also the attraction to boys culture and the attraction to boys, like as people, I've just always socialized with men really well. I've always socialized with guys well. I've always made guy friends well. I can like interface with them and understand them. And I understand like how they get along and stuff.
How does that compare to how you've connected with women in your life?
Women are awesome, but they're a different, there's a different way I interface with them. I will say I do struggle a little bit more with female bosses than I do with male bosses.
What do you think that is?
I don't know. I think it's just in the modern American education system, it's more rare to have a male authority figure or a male teacher.
That's
and
true.
I think female teachers, like, you're just more accustomed to it. So I really sought out like more male authority figures and more male mentors, I think.
Right.
I think all young men do, you know?
Yeah, but it's interesting how you say in contrast, because I kind of did a weird hybrid where I was always going back and forth, which kind of it makes sense that I realized I was bisexual. But I was like a boy who was largely attracted to girls, but also very interested in like, I was in dance class. And I was in all of that artsy stuff and I wanted to be surrounded. It's interesting. It's kind of what you're describing in an inverted way. But the reason I ask you about your experience is because so many of my other queer friends growing up would gravitate in the other way. They would kind of realize that they were sensitive or they were with the girls. They would spend their time with the girls doing artistic things. And you're like, that seems counter. Yours makes way more sense.
No,
you're gay.
Some people
hang out
get
with the boys.
Bullied by the boys and go with the girls. I got bullied by the boys and I was like, the boys are awesome. Like, I'm all about this. This is power. This is like great.
Got it. That's fascinating.
And I also feel like even nowadays, I think men get a bad rap and it's a tough thing. So, and I'm curious how that has to do with your professors at UNCSA, because those were a lot of guy professors. The film school is a lot of dudes.
Yeah, that's true.
So that was like really interesting, that being a formative chapter there on out.
You know, you're so right, dude. And I hadn't really thought about that, but we have this kind of societal thing set up, right? Where, you know, let's say you're following all of the traditional gender norms. And I'm about to make a bunch of sweeping generalizations for the sake of argument, accepting and taking for granted that there are exceptions and outliers to what I'm about to say. But let's say you grow up in a male-female father-mother relationship, and you grow up with a father that is working and a mother that is home with the kids. Mm-hmm. Let's say that's your dynamic. You're starting mostly and largely quantity. You're spending time with female energy. You know, mom's in charge for the first little bit.
Yeah.
Then you go to school. And like you said, for like the next 12 years, unless you get into sports, women are telling you what to do.
So I've always loved...
But then you enter the professional world and it's traditionally, depending on your field, inverted.
Right.
So after 13, 15, 18 years of ladies telling you what to do, whether you're male or female, you enter into the world and now it's all guys telling you what to do.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's an interesting dichotomy, dude. I don't know if I'd really wrap my brain about it being that way. Were you really hyper aware of that at the time?
I was like, hyper aware of so much, yet so not aware of so many other things.
Like what?
Like, so this is also me being one of the younger people to come on your pod.
Right.
I always tell people this, but like when I was 14, I knew what like pronouns were and like trans right. stuff. And you know, all this stuff, you have all this knowledge of like what Black trans women of color are and all these things that were out there in the world. And yet you don't even know your own self or how to sort your own self out or what you're attracted to or who you are, how to like live in the world. So everyone's really, and I noticed when I would teach in high schools, everyone was really equipped with a lot of language, and people don't have knowledge of self that comes way later or never.
What do you think the fallout of that is in contrast to like someone, you know, I'm not like a million years older than you, man. It's just like a one generation. No,
how old do you think I am?
I don't even say that as any kind of defensiveness because I'm not. I say it to point out, like, despite the fact that we went to school right. at different times and I was older than my class, so I'm even a little bit older than I would be had that lined up. But that being said, it's barely a generation, if that. So I'm like, if we see just that gap between the two of us, what do you think is the impact on kids' identities and the way that they go into things like making art or go right. into things like political activism or the things that they're like, let me go do this with my life. And like you said, there's so much more input and almost not enough processing.
No, you can't process.
How could you?
You can't process. It's like, and that with high school, you've got so many boxes to tick off and so much stuff to do. I don't think people have as much time just doing the like classic, like, you know, like Dazed and Confused, just hanging out, spending copious amounts of time with your peers. I don't think people get that much.
Did you go to a high school that focused on things like rank and stuff like that? Were you paying attention to that?
I went to high school with 3,500 kids. So it was very hard to rise up in the class rank.
Mm-hmm. Did you know what it was on a regular basis? Like what your rank was?
Or no, but I think that. No, I was very lucky in that I could do the whole academic thing. And then when I was 16, 17, that's when I discovered like more artistic things. And I was once again more drawn to film than drama. And yeah, like that was cool. And I was free to explore my artistic side and my academic side and a lot of other stuff. Like I kind of made time for all of it. But I will say that it's just undeniable that like, I just think like the younger people get and the more the years go on, like the younger kids have a lot more structured time, a lot more quantitative life. Like
yeah.
a lot of what you do is quantified. Well, with standardized testing.
Right.
That's yeah. another huge standardized testing.
It really became big.
Quantified social life on social media, like all of these
right,
things.
Right, right. Everything's numerical.
Qualified. And... Yeah. So,
we need a little bit more right side of the brain. Just let it go yeah. and flow and be. And no, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that that's one of the things that I'm seeing as kind of a progressive new age hippy dippy thing, which
yeah.
really should be treated as like, maybe we all need to spend some time on this, which is like, you'll see these, you know, on social media, you'll see an article somewhere like this teacher is not doing homework anymore. They're like, go home and spend
oh,
time
yeah.
with your dog.
I taught at a elementary school in Atwater Village where you got like a pronouns name tag, and this is for like really little kids.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think we're yet to see what the fallout is gonna be. I think we're yet to see the fallout. Such a nasty word. It makes it sound like it's gonna be like bad stuff's gonna happen. No, I think it's
right.
just I have no idea what we're gonna see with the generation that grows up with a more like fluid concept of all this stuff. But once again,
right.
I was aware of some of these things when I was 14. I was aware of like, you know, the Stonewall riots and like so much stuff. I had Tumblr, so I learned about the Stonewall riots and the Tulsa massacre and this crazy, you know, this like almost this like UC Berkeley level of like hyper leftist thought.
Right.
And I was interested in all that. And you know what? I still ended up a pretty boyish boy who was into
right.
the stuff I was into, like
right.
even being introduced to all that stuff via internet cultural diffusion. I still ended up liking what I liked. So
Here's something that I want to talk to you about, man. I think this is, this came up on a recent podcast. When it airs, I'm not sure. So I won't drop the name of who it was, but we were talking about how the school is different. Someone who graduated more recently.
Okay, yeah.
And they were talking about how things have changed, and we were really trying to get into, as best we could, kind of the nitty gritty without just accepting that like completely different people are in charge of certain things. And so it's a complete, it's just different. That's just how it's going to be. But then it's like, what is the difference in the education that someone might be getting now versus then? And the two biggest things that I can think of, at least that affected, I would think, drama and probably film the most since I graduated, are COVID and Me Too. Mm-hmm. Both of those things really changed the industry. That was the first year
I went into college. 2017, the fall of 2017 was the year that Me Too exploded. And that was the first year of my first semester of film school.
And so, okay, so let's get into this a little bit, because I feel like the COVID thing, not so much, but the Me Too thing has a big part of this. All of the gender and sexual identity stuff we've been talking about is also a part of this. The person I was talking to's assessment of the culture at the school was that at least you can only tell why you're there, but it seemed like, and I hear about this. I don't want to sound like fucking Trump over here with people who's saying, but I do hear from a lot of different people on different campuses that this trend is pervasive, which is the faculty want to help the students have a better experience. Of course, the students want to have a better experience. The faculty are confused about what the right moves are to make sure that they give them the experience. And these issues that they're struggling to understand and work with seem to be better understood by their student body than by themselves. So they solicit the opinions, advice, and overall intention of the student body to inform how they, the faculty, will then conduct the school in order to be sensitive to all of these different things. That line of logic makes sense to me. It does obviously present the problem of students wouldn't be present in front of faculty if they didn't lack information. The whole point of going to school is you don't know yet.
There's a lot to learn from that older generation.
So the question is, how much do you, I'm going to be kind of plain on purpose here and blatant. How much do you let the kids run the school? You just left in the big scheme. I think that conversation is being had more at that school and at schools like it than it ever has, because in my assessment, Charlie, and this is my final parenthetical, this is my final parenthetical, and yes, I do want your answer. That was already happening at other liberal arts schools in America for like a while on a slow creep. And the conservatory idea was really resistant to that, because they're like, we have an old time tested structure. Mm-hmm. We hired people who have already accomplished a lot in this industry. So we're taking it for granted that we are very well informed in how to teach you. You're lucky that we're teaching you. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how you should feel about it. And it seems like maybe even the conservatories or the more focused schools have now bended even to the, well, what do you think? And it's like, well, what do you think? Only goes so far when they're the ones paying you for what you think. You know what I mean? That's my assessment. What do you think?
Oh, I think there's a lot of knowledge to be learned from the elders, especially in the arts.
Sure.
I think that, I guess I'm old fashioned or a little bit more conservative in that regard, that I listen to my elders. I really do. And, you know, there are people going up and giving, those teachers knew about Me Too. They were there. Those teachers knew about some of the liberal and progressive things that revolutionized the film industry. They were there. They were making, you know, Del Pollack, the old dean of film, was this young, wide-eyed, Jewish, liberal from the East Coast, Hollywood Reporter writer in the 1970s in Hollywood. I mean, he saw the Wild West.
Right.
And he won his first, I think it was a Pulitzer, for writing about the Teamsters and unions and stuff. All this stuff, unions. Oh, we've discovered unions aren't new, dude. Like,
right.
All of some of this stuff these guys have been doing. And then, you know, I feel like I'm a little bit more conservative on that side, because, like, you know, there were people talking about racial reckoning and racial revolutions and stuff like that. And I was sitting there and I'm like, you guys aren't asking, you know, my professor, Ron Stacker Thompson, who was a pioneer of the New Black Arts Movement and who worked with Maya Angelou and Winston-Salem, like lived at her house in Winston-Salem, and they were in San Francisco and New York, and he wrote the first play, and he was the first Black Jesus on Godspell, and he wrote a play about, you know, Frederick Douglass and Frederick Dunbar, who were these two Black writers who had this friendship and relationship, and he wrote a musical about it and premiered on it. But people, you know, they lose this history. They don't want to. So I just like am big on the listen to your elders train. And I also think there's room for both that and some really radical new people. And I do think that this is less college. I have mixed feelings about college, but in the industry, in Hollywood, I think some of those older people that don't have something to teach anymore, which a lot of them don't, that don't want to teach anymore, that don't want to help the younger generation, that don't want, they need to step out of the way. And let the new generation lead.
What does that look like? Like, what is stepping out of the way?
Retiring.
Stop making things?
If you don't want to mentor people, then... I mean, I think, like, there was a great article where the Holy Trinity of Mexican film directors sat down and talked together. Cuarón, Del Toro, and Iñárritu. And the three of them... basically all came upon, they're kind of talking about the future of cinema, just like shooting the shit last year. Those guys have been friends for forever. And Del Toro said, he's like, the thing about the modern film industry is that it really did used to be a lot more of a mentorship system. It really did used to be a lot
theater
more
too.
Of like training people on the job. And you got a job and you got trained and you, it took years and years and years. And by the time you came through it, you worked for a lot of people and it was really, you had something. And, which I don't usually think about this perspective, but Del Toro said, he's like, people are given the reins way too soon. Like just take the years and the years and the years to learn the craft. And,
but there's a thing that's changed in that dynamic. And I was just talking about this in another context with somebody else about a completely different industry, which is like,
what industry?
I was talking about farming.
Farming. Wow.
Yeah. Very different. And I was talking about how in my family, cause most of my family going back are like ranchers and roughnecks, oil workers and stuff like that. And one of the big things in my family is not about, inheritance is not a very big deal where I come from. Like if you have land, maybe, but it's not about your goal as a person is to build up a lot of money and then give it to your kids or whatever. And I know a lot of people that seems to be kind of the overall plan, right? Mm-hmm. It's like build up some wealth and pass it on and they can be happy. And, okay. But my family's attitude is that is not that valuable. The legacy, the whole point is you pass on the values and the skills.
Absolutely.
You teach them how to do the things and care about the things that you did so that when you're gone, those skills and those values still exist in the world. They're mm-hmm. still contributing to what we're all doing. And so even though it was clear to my family that I wasn't going to stay on the farm and work with my hands in that same way, the values of working with your hands, of building things and all that kind of stuff is in me in a really serious way that I can't really ever shake. And I think that one
it's
of
a
the
huge
things,
value in my family.
Yeah.
Well.
It's a big deal. And to me, I'm like, I don't care if I leave my kids any money. If I ever have any kids, I want to make sure that they get that they care about, you know, they have to care about the same things I do, but, to have values that I think help everybody and put good things in the world. And to tie this back to what we're talking about, there I feel because of the explosion of availability of information, skill sets no longer live entirely in people that you have to get them out of in order to learn how to do it. My mentor, Gerald Friedman, who I was his last directing student.
Right.
And he had already had strokes and stuff, had aphasia, has trouble communicating, but he's still educating me and I still learned from him. And it felt like there was the Library of Alexandria, or in this case of the Library of Gerald Friedman. And there was someone walking around going, we're closing up. everybody finish your books.
Wow.
And I'm like, shit. Oh, what else do you know? Like what, you know, yeah. And you're trying to get that because I'm from that old school mentality of you get the knowledge and the skills from the people.
From the people.
More so than you go anywhere else for it. And I think that whether you can get the same education from like watching a YouTube clip versus taking a class with a person, I'm not even here to say one way or the other, honestly. I think I'm too old and dumb to even equivocate those. But I will say one of them didn't used to exist. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of mentality, even in people who aren't the same age, of like, but we should be teaching each other in the space, doing the things together, being like, oh, hey, kid, next time use this wrench. Like you should be proactive in your work in making your skill set available to those and passing it on and doing all that kind of stuff, because that's where we brought up. But when the information's all out there,
yeah,
and you don't have to go pry it out of an old man or an old woman, and you feel as though you can just go get it, whatever that means, it changes the way so people think about being qualified, yeah, about being a craftsperson, yeah, about trade.
I mean, listen, Dale, the professor I mentioned, Pollock, trained under David Geffen, the biggest name in entertainment ever. Yeah. He was the assistant to David Geffen, and that was what he did for like, I want to say 5 years. And then he became his own producer, came onto his own. Ron was the assistant to, I want to say, Bill Duke, who directed a lot of black action films in the 1980s and 90s, but he was also close friends with Michael Mann, who was like coming up above him, and he was an assistant for like years. And I was an assistant very briefly to a famous like Beverly Hills like fashion photographer, and you know, like hear all the stories from like old London about like Andy Warhol and Basquiat. We used to do this, and you cannot learn that stuff in another way than
like, I tend to agree with
having
you, man,
to look into the face of the old way of doing things, which we all overly glorify and fetishize it.
Sure.
Obviously there are new cool ways of doing things now. Obviously there's not one right way, but like, of course we glorify the old way. It's like so cool.
But
like,
there seems to be a thing, and you don't seem to experience this, Charlie. And please tell me what it's like for you when you talk to other people that are your age in this way, which is, like you said, it's like they miss the context. It's like they're the Overton window for their awareness of history has gotten so much shorter in such a short period of time. Mm-hmm. Even in entertainment, which modern entertainment is not very old. It's not that much research to do, really, the big ones. You know, you spend a semester studying film and television since 1950, you're going to be pretty caught up. Like, you may not know how to make all of it, but just knowing like, actually we've come this far. This used to be a big deal. This was the first person that was openly gay that did this. This was the first all that identity stuff you care about. Understand when things happened and when they took place and how things changed. And I just feel like the farther we go, the average 20-year-old I talk to, whether it was in 2000, 2010, now, in 10 years, it seems to be a progressive thing of what they're aware of that's happened.
Yeah.
Is smaller, especially in the immediate future. I think we're all kind of dumb about ancient history. Mm-hmm. People only know what they know. And that used to be the thing we made fun of. It'd be like, this guy doesn't know wars and stuff. That's off the table. No one fucking knows wars anymore.
I don't know enough about wars.
No, one knows wars. That's
probably
gone.
Important.
We're all off the hook on wars, people. You don't have to know wars anymore.
Yeah.
But you do. When was it? Czechoslovakia? It was two? Whatever.
Dude,
no one cares.
With the Baltics.
Nobody
cares. I gotta learn
it's
about
over.
That someday.
We're done. We'll never catch up to that. That's a far and away dream that we would know those kinds of things. But like, you talk to people who say these blatant things that like are sweeping generalizations. And then you're like, except for that one, what was the one that just happened? And she's not even a young person. It killed me. She got on stage and I like her. She's a female director and actor, Elizabeth Banks. Mm-hmm. She was like doing a thing and she said, Steven Spielberg's like never made a movie with a female lead or whatever. And like said that on stage in front of all these people. And they're like, The Color Purple.
Oh,
like,
right.
Oh
right.
Shit. Like she, even she, it's like people want to jump to be like, this has never happened, or this is the first, or this is the thing.
Yeah.
They're not so diligent in making sure that that's the case because they don't go look into it. But you don't seem to have that kind of brain. You're very aware. You seem to know like the touchstones. Yeah. Why do you think that made its way into the way you think? And then what's your experience like when you talk to other people your age who are not like that?
Well, I think that the modern era can be very hostile sometimes. So I think I do like go into my antiquarian interests as kind of like a...
What's the word you just used?
Antiquarian. I learned it from H.P. Lovecraft.
No, I love that. What's that word mean?
Fave, but
no, let's go.
An antiquarian is a person who loves the antique.
Oh, got it. Sure.
It's like a 100-year-old term, but...
I love that. Appropriately, it's kind of outdated.
And I really have something... You got to remind me to tell you about my like UNCSA drama deep dive into the 70s, but...
Please.
First, I'll say that a lot of it's just... I'm of two minds because on one mind, I love like looking into the past and just learning from it. And for example, the movie Babylon that came out last year, I was watching that and it's about silent film. And in a really like reductive way to put it, Babylon helped me realize that right now, the whole TikTok era, TikTok is just silent film. Yeah. Original silent film was people who didn't have talent, who couldn't act, but they were hot and charismatic and could move their bodies well.
Right.
And that is what TikTok is.
It was something to look at.
It's just people moving their bodies and it's commotion, but it's also timing. It's also like, it's literally the original silent film stars were like not Shakespearean actors. The Shakespearean actors poo-pooed them. Like they were just like hot, charismatic people that happened to be in Southern California at one point in history.
Right. When the machine showed up that could capture what they were doing.
Yeah. So it was literally the exact, but if you watch the films, they're so physical comedy and timing based and like verbal. So like, or nonverbal. So, I mean, when you really think about it, like that comforted me in an era where I'm like, I don't know if I can like wake up another day and have to look at another Instagram reel or TikTok as like these like things that are so, you know, like there's just a lot of cheap, dumb media. Like there's a lot of it. And I don't know if I can like live in a world where this is like dominant, more dominant than movies or TV. But in reality, like we've been here before, guys.
Yeah.
We've been in a time when people would go to the Nickelodeon and like watch movies that were just about like these very like, cave painting or more like cave shadow images of like people like having.
But how many other people your age are recognizing the parallels between the silent film era and TikTok media? You do see what I'm saying? That you're kind of pointing out the point that I made, which is like, yeah, Charlie, you're sharp. Yeah. And you seem to be locked into art in a really careful way. And I don't mean careful like delicate. I mean careful like you care and you're taking the time. And My curiosity is like, what, I mean, we're just two people kind of pontificating uselessly here, but what is the future of making stuff if everyone's awareness of the past is so short-sighted? I mean, someone's going to stand up in a few months and be like, I wrote the greatest pop song of all time. It's called Jesse's Girl. And it's motherfucker.
Which they do. That happens all the time. Like the top songs this year were Nicki Minaj chopping up other rap songs. Which
and don't get me wrong. I love a mashup. I love a remix. I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan. You know, we take the themes that we love and we remix them into a new thing. Yeah. I'm not against this. I just mean like, it's one thing to be Tarantino and to recognize I'm taking these Western themes, these Eastern Kung Fu thing. I'm gonna put this together on purpose because I love them. It's another thing to not know what you're drawing from.
And I mean, when you get someone who's that knowledgeable of what you're drawing from, you get Greta Gerwig using classical paintings to inspire the shots of Little Women.
Right.
She didn't go off of film references for that. She looked at paintings of the time and like was like costume. That's when you get really great craft, is when you get people that really pay attention to detail.
You know what makes me feel, you're really absolutely on the money. And I used to come home all the time from school when I was a kid, and I would tell my dad how frustrated I was with like whoever was bullying me or the teacher was mean or whatever. And this is probably why I have such an ego problem. I think I've said this on the pod before. No, it's true. I would complain and my dad would be like, you should be really grateful that there's all those nasty, stupid people at school. And I was like,
he's saying any bad attention is attention. Any attention is good attention.
No, the opposite. He's saying, be grateful that those nasty, stupid people are there because they give you the litmus for yourself. That's how you know you're good and smart.
Yeah.
Because you're not mean and you're not stupid. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't really know where you landed on the spectrum if you didn't realize that so many people are nasty and stupid. That's what makes you special.
Yeah.
And so in a way, he was like, instead of trying to reframe it, he was trying to tell me, it's like, well, just take comfort in the fact that you're better than everyone, which is not a helpful way to think.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I bounce it back to the Greta Gerwig thing you said, which is like, so what if a lot of people get worse at a thing you do? Because truthfully, it makes you a little bit shinier when you know what the fuck you're doing. And the only thing that bums me out is like, I do want to live in a world of abundance. I want to live in a world where there's too many great, awesome, wonderful, well-made things to do. And I get to pick from all of them rather than scarcity. But I agree with you, man. I think it's cyclical. I think a lot of what we're dealing with is stuff that's going to come full around. But the big difference is just the volume of information thing.
Yeah.
It's like there's so much TikTok to watch. They don't have time to watch. You know, they might make time to watch something like Citizen Kane or Gone with the Wind because some old person, or they saw it on some Criterion list or a thing, whatever. Like they might do that, but they might not watch Beverly Hills Cop. You know, they might not watch like Pretty Woman. You know, they might not watch Guns of the Navarone. Like there's things that just may slip by them because there's just too much. There's just too much to get to. And there's so many great things that trickle down into that TikTok you like. They're doing a Scorsese joke. You don't even realize it, you know, which maybe that's fine. But to me, part of the fun is like seeing all that work to, it's like watching Family Guy and not knowing American culture. How would you get a single joke? God,
Family Guy is amazing.
I love it.
If I could be a writer on one show.
But my wife didn't grow up watching TV being that locked into American culture. So when she watches it, every joke about an 80s movie or a 90s TV show or an outfit or it just goes over her head.
It's so like Seth MacFarlane loves like razzle dazzle show tunes, American culture, baby. Like Family Guy, last
80s
vestige.
Movies in Broadway.
And last no one knew that's of what American that show culture was. That's fallen into the water,
right?
Now, fallen into the ocean. Yeah.
So you said something about schoolyard 70s deep dive.
Yep. So that was, I think, a fitting conclusion to this is I was like trying to learn how to write screenplays and I had written a couple. And then the first one that I wrote that really hit, that I really learned how to write something, was something that the UNCSA screenwriting program was really focused on research third year.
Okay.
You had to do these really strange things for your curriculum. It wasn't about writing at all. We had to go to a hospice to meet a man who was dying and interview him. I had to go to an AA meeting or an Al-Anon meeting to meet a bunch of addicts or people who are suffering from addicts and like just sit there for 2 hours and listen. And I, for a while, did like an interview project where I met a lot of UNCSA professors from the 70s because I was really interested in like AIDS at the time. Mm-hmm. Where like I have all these photos on my Instagram and stuff, but I have all these cool photos of like UNCSA from the time. And I was like, it's gotta be like a cool like secret history backstory here. And I'm like, of course there was. And then there's like tons of like cool stuff. And that was how I learned, you know. And so I wrote this screenplay about like the years before AIDS, when the school was this libertine, crazy place. Because they actually, at the time I was writing that screenplay, it was the time of the pandemic. And actually, no one will tell you this, and a lot of this is take it with a grain of salt, but they shut down the school during AIDS and everyone had to go home, like COVID, because there were so many gay students. And because so many people and just straight students were,
we can't teach three kids in this class. Mm-hmm. Half the damn group is out or gone.
So some people got it, and professors, of course, too.
Right, of course.
So weirdly, while I was like writing that COVID,
whoa,
while I was in COVID, I was writing the story about
that's
this ever
trippy, dude.
Pandemic.
What a parallel.
But I didn't write the screenplay about the like that part of it. I wrote the screenplay just about
before
like, this fantasia, this imagining of what it could have been like, and you know, that's where I included characters in it that like. One of them, his name was Bartleby St. McCloud, and I can't remember who the real guy's name is, but
so good.
He has a very like similar name to that, but he was the son of two UNCSA professors, and he went on to become a New York Times theater critic. Gerald would have known him.
Yeah.
And Robert.
I almost feel like, all that adds up to something.
And that's how I met Robert
remember.
Beseda. We got lunch and we talked for a long time, and he gave me this ginormous textbook sized book called Who the Devil Made It. He might have told you about it. Who the Devil Made It, interviews with famous film directors, and it's just 1,000 pages of old boomer film directors talking about it.
He used to teach the only film class that was
book.
In the drama school.
Yeah. Robert amazing did. Guy. So he gave me that book. And there was that and Beth Petty. And I was already really close with Dale Pollack, who wasn't around till the 90s. But yeah, I was, I just was really fascinated by that time period and all this history. And it started with a craft fascination with photos because we can never see those plays. That's right. The thing that's amazing about theater. But it's also, I mean, film's amazing. It's literally transports you to another time period, like the film Cruising, the William Friedman film. William Friedman recently died, but the actors in those films are the scenes that were in the like clubs in New York in the 70s pre-AIDS. Like, there's no footage of that world anymore. So many people and humans, and it was such a different place. And the only footage we'll ever have is in this like sleazy cop, you know, serial killer movie that's amazing. But films that we have, and then for all those UNCSA memories and what it must have been like, there's oral history. Which you're contributing to the world of podcasts is oral history and photography. So
have you been to the Keith Haring Museum?
No.
The exhibit that's here at the Broad.
Have you been?
Yeah. Cool. I went on my birthday. Cool. It's fucking amazing. You have to go. One of my favorite things that's there is he had this campaign for a while where he was going to all the subway stations in New York and taking the poster size black spaces that were empty because they hadn't put another poster up, and he was using chalk to do like his artwork in those spaces. So it would be like a poster for like Lethal Weapon, and then right next to it would be like a Keith Haring piece.
Cool.
And he went fucking everywhere, but it's considered vandalism. And so he got arrested more than once. And there's video of him in the 80s.
Yeah.
Doing the graffiti, like doing the chalk graffiti and getting arrested at the museum, like playing on loop. And it was one of the coolest things there because I just sat there watching this clip of him, you know, on those, whatever camera they were shooting it on and all that kind of stuff. And even though it's all grainy and it almost looks like a damn security camera, I mean, I felt like I was there. It just, it captures it in a way that you just, and it almost looked like a news real thing that they covered or something. I don't know, but that kind of stuff really, really ties me to it. And I think that's another thing that I'm very curious about. You know, I mean, we talked a lot about the AIDS epidemic while I was in school at
it's
School
a big
of the Arts.
Fascination for young artists.
It's a fascination, but it's also one of the things that not all of our teachers, but some of our teachers in drama, and one of them in particular, was almost like, this is your legacy. Like, you're a descendant of these people. It's they're my friends. Mm-hmm. I would have other people here who might be teachers alongside me teaching you if this hadn't happened. Like, and you have to understand that just one generation ahead of you, this thing happened where we were in these communities of artists and we were making cool shit, just like you guys are, just like you're excited about, and you're trying to figure all this stuff out. And we felt just like you. And then in a matter of a very short period of time, more than half our friends died. What the fuck? And even our generation doesn't have anything to compare to because COVID didn't get us the way that it got older people. So even that comparison, and it doesn't target like queer community or something, you know, it's not specific like that in the way that it ended up working out. So we can't relate, but I just feel like when you walk into a room and you start talking really fucking loud in front of everyone, maybe you should get an idea of what they were talking about before you walked in. Maybe you should get an idea of what is happening. And I feel like more and more, and I include my own generation in this, man, millennials, we're the worst about this too. We just walk in and start being like, now listen. And it's like, hey, we've been here for a while. Doing shit. You are joining something here.
Absolutely.
Not starting something. And I really appreciated that my teachers went out of their way to kind of be like, you're joining something.
Yes.
You're not starting
That's
something.
That's what I need right now in my current work. I have some great artist peers, but I need more. Like, I don't know if that's like an LA thing.
Yes, it
is. Or like, everyone's so spread out, it's so hard to find. Like, I've been here 2 years. I've met some amazing artists, but I don't feel like I'm in that scene currently.
You know what else though is a part of it? And it took me a while to figure this out about LA, because people have said that for a while. Like, oh, it's because we live far apart. No, it isn't. That's nothing to do with that. I'll take a fucking hour and a half train from the Harlem to Brooklyn to hang out with my friends when I live there.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's not the time. It is, I really think it's the way a lot of the industry works. And what it is that in New York, when you're young and you're an artist, everybody of course, would love a sweet ass gig that pays really well. There's not that many of them. And so what happens in New York is a lot of people make their own shit. They're like, oh, well, if they're not going to give us the sweet ass gig on Broadway, we'll do our own theater, right?
The minimum wage isn't even as high there. The jobs just aren't as good.
We'll make it happen on our own collaboratively. That's the theater solution and the film solution in New York.
Yeah.
In LA, we all want the big gig at the big show. For the most part, that's what people want, even if it's for a little while. So then later you can make your own thing. But it's like we all would love a big gig at a big show. And the thing about LA is they don't say, fuck you, go home, we're not interested. They say, ah, we can give you a little thing on a little thing. Mm-hmm. And you're like, sold. But you can't bring your friends. And now you don't have time to make a thing with your friends.
Wow.
Because you have the little thing on the little thing. And then you get a little thing on the big thing. And you're like, I can't, guys. I got to, I'm almost at the big thing at the big thing. Mm-hmm. It feels like you can at least get in, participate. You could PA, you could something. And now that I guess we have time to make a movie because no one will hire us and we're all working at the same bar, doesn't happen.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah.
It also, we get a little bit more spread out. That's an element. But I really think it's more about how the mindset works in making stuff when it's like, you're not going to get hired to be a first AD on the next Marvel movie if you're a film student. That's not like the thing that's going to happen for you. But you might get a PA job on like Barry season 4, and that ain't nothing. You're like, fucking, that's huge. I want to go be on that set. It's a PA, but I want to take that. And that exists in New York for sure. But I find much more of the community. And then that's the other big part, Charlie, is there's more film out here and there's more drama in New York, and dance is kind of split and the rest of them kind of are all over the place. But the truth—
And no one has possibly thought of a way that there could be another city where we could do all of this in. That could never—
When they start having enough jobs for us to do that, we'll go there 100%. And we got people in Atlanta and we got some people in DC where there's some theater.
Theater, yeah.
But it'll always be where the work is. I'm one of them. The number of people that would live somewhere else if they could still do their job. But for right now, that's how it works. And I think it also has to do with community size. You know, I can't speak to film because I was never in the film school, even though I was in two of the others. I was never in film. And so I don't know what it's like to be a film student out here, but I did live with two film students for the first 2 years that I lived in LA. My two roommates were both film grads from 2009 and 2010. And the amount of other film buddies that like came over to our place, which was big enough to host, was low. You know, it's like they all have their things, they're doing things.
Yeah.
And the collaboration was a little bit more limited. And I just think that's an LA, New York thing a little bit. I really long for, and I'm kind of utopitarian about this. I wish we had a better alumni network. This podcast is part of my effort to try to do that. I'm not going to take on the nonprofit job of running the alumni thing. The school's tried many times in different ways to do it. They have a new group of people working in advancement right now and working on alumni stuff that are great. My buddy, John Bowers, who's been on this podcast and we're old roommates and best friends, is involved with that and planning events. We got a homecoming coming up. It's super cool. But it is a drag because I will tell you this, bud, and you'll probably find this over the years as you've been out of school longer, and please hook up with me later. Let me know if I'm right about this. There's like an ease, a comfort, a vocabulary. I just can't talk to or make things with anybody else as efficiently and as comfortably as I can with even strangers at Schoolyards.
Yeah.
I just meet one other person and I found out you went there. Dude, I don't know you, but I'm totally comfortable talking to you. Mm-hmm. I feel like we could go work on a project right now. And even if we saw it differently, we'd probably figure it out and get it done. And like, yeah. And I can't say that about every single person I went to school with, but I'll say this. The people I went to school with that I maybe didn't click with, I bet you I'd click way fucking better with them now than I ever did at school, because I have the even bigger context of how valuable they are in all the ways I just mentioned. You know what I mean? Are you finding that with other people that you went to school with? Were you close with a lot of your class? Are you out here making stuff with people? Or What's that dynamic?
I live with another film, two other film students.
Your age?
The year below me and then the year below him.
So okay, got it.
Two younger. I always was kind of like mentoring people as best I could. I do. Yeah, UNCSA people are like my phone calls I get and have with UNCSA people in other places, not just New York and North Carolina, but just everywhere, are like very valued and cherished, like those phone calls. In LA, yeah, definitely. It's like you said, people are so talented, but they're in their own lane, you know? They're doing their own thing. Yeah, they're so talented. Like, I can't. That's the thing I'm actually optimistic about. I think I just need to be a little bit more proactive myself and like instigating those relationships and like reaching out to you. And like, but yeah, no, my friend Ashley is an amazing writer. She has a great job at a studio. She's like just amazing, sensitive, deep screenwriter. But I had to instigate that friendship. So like the day I came to LA, I called her and she was like, Charlie, what are you? And I'm like, I know I only hung out with you once at Ron Stecker Thompson's house. I know I only talked to you a couple times, but I'm going to be your best friend now. And I'm coming to your house.
I love
and
this.
And then I came to her house and then, yeah, we've been really close friends for 2 years now.
Just so I get a sense of it. And I just want to, cause you know, a lot of times at school, like I said, or on this podcast, we talk about kind of the act three, which is the after school. That act is your shortest act right now, which will change in time. So I want to kind of replace that with maybe this last question will help me get an idea of it. Because I think I know. Obviously, screenwriting is your thing. Obviously, storytelling is your thing. It really seems like you are interested in trying to tell stories that don't occur to you as obvious right away. Mm-hmm. If you were to cite a show that's come on or a film that's come out in the last 5 years, let's say, maybe I'll give you 10, that you're like, man, I wish I could have just been in that writer's room.
Yeah.
I wish I could have sat with that person as they made that thing, because it's damn close to a thing I would have made. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just my sensibilities. It's the kind of characters. It's the whatever. What do you feel like lives really close to that? That almost like, man, if that could be my next mentor, that would be dope.
I have a couple answers.
Yeah, sky's the limit, man.
I keep very meticulous lists of all the stuff I like.
Good. That's a great idea.
One per year. So I have like a 2022 year and a 2023 year. And I also like just don't want to be one of those people who like wants to be in the industry, but like doesn't answer that.
Yeah.
And I like to ask actors that question. I like to ask them because that's my gauge as to whether you're a good actor or not. Or not a good actor, but like one that like really has it or not. Because I'll ask, what's your dream role? What would be a role that you know? And a lot of them go, I don't know. I'm an actor. There's no such thing as it. But then some of them just go, they know it.
Yeah.
They know the movie star. They know the role in the film that they've seen in their life. They're like, I would be great as that. And I love that. I want to work with those actors that were like,
it's
I would
a starting
be great
place.
As that. And I'm stalling because I'm having a really hard time like thinking of a TV show.
Would it be a TV show versus film? Do you want to be a TV writer?
I don't even know what TV is anymore. With it's so as an art form, I don't know what a TV show is anymore. There's miniseries, there's long series, like everything is a miniseries. Like the American model is shifting into the British model now.
No, and that's what it is. Writer. It's not, don't
so
overthink it.
I would
it's
say
that.
Fleabag is the best show ever, right?
Okay.
Like I would say that blend of dark comedy, dark humor was really dope to me, but I would also say that once again, everything is shifting to the model of there being one. I love Brian Fuller. He's a screenwriter who wrote American Gods and Hannibal. That was my favorite show.
Yeah.
And he does a really good job handling genre elements. So I haven't checked in on those worlds in a while. He did Star Trek. Like he'll start a show and then go from a thing to a thing. But I liked Hannibal and these long poetic monologues the characters would give about philosophy while they would hunt down serial killers. And they hired David Slade to direct the episodes, who would do these it wasn't a serial killer, the show that just looked like Fincher. It was the opposite, because every serial killer show and every show in the 2010s looks like Fincher. You know, like everything ever looks like Fincher now.
It certainly has the flavor of that. Yeah.
Right. And
which is hilarious to me, because I love so many of the shows that would fall in that category, and I'm not a David Fincher fan at all.
But here's the funny thing you're saying about Hannibal. Was a 2013 show, and I loved that show, and it was amazing. But it's been 10 years since that. And that was, I would consider Hannibal, I was watching these amazing shows like Penny Dreadful and Hannibal, and shows that, you know, it really was this promising time. And then over the years, we've had the 10 years of peak TV, whatever. And I think we're kind of in trough TV. Now I think we're in a very different era.
I think we're in transition sure. I think trough is intense, but might be accurate. It really depends. There's a few different things that I've seen in the past few years that I'm really inspired by. And I watch the way people are critical of it, and I have to step back because I just don't agree.
Yeah, it's like, get over yourself. You didn't make the show.
Yeah. And I'm big about that. I mean, we'd have a separate 2-hour podcast about how I'm very like, you know how that show should have ended? However the fuck the writers say it should have ended, because you don't get to say how shows end. I mean, you can have your opinion, but like, whatever. That's how it ended, kid. Sorry.
Yeah. Did you watch all the Joss Whedon, Buffy, Firefly, all the shows that were ended abruptly and like very like, back when just they would just end shows, and it was such a big thing.
I was definitely very much watching TV and aware of those at the time. Yeah. I didn't watch Buffy and Firefly, but my best friends did.
Because now these shows just end. Shows just end. Shows don't live anymore. They don't have years and years and seasons.
And I love this idea. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of, you know, and Vince Gilligan kind of hit one out of the park with this style. The guys over on Lost did it too, which is you've got a mega show on your hands and you say, no, we're going to write an ending. Like, we're going to end it on purpose. Whether you end up liking what they do with it or not, I love the idea that people said, we want to finish it up and go do something else. Like,
That's a great show. The other two just did that. They did 3 seasons and they were out.
Barry just did it too. Ted Lasso did it too, where they kind of just made a plan after they got the hit. And we're like, oh, okay. Now that we've got a hit and we like what we're doing, let's make an arc so that we know where we're at on it, which, you know, when we study storytelling at all, is pretty fucking helpful. One of my favorite shows from the past like 20 years that had the opposite problem, which is, it's kind of fun to go watch. And then you watch, you're like, man, they didn't know what they were doing. Showtime, Californication with David Duchovny.
Sure,
every season they were sure they're going to get canceled, so they wrote a series finale every year. And so
Buffy, they would always end it with a crazy finale.
It's got to have a series finale. And then the season premiere of the following one has to do this like backpedal story of like, that guy's not really dead, or it was a dream, or now they're going to go over here. And I get that, because when you're working there, and back when the model was what it was, I mean, I think that's what you had to do. You want to make sure it's good, but you also don't want to leave people hanging. But I think I like the transition. I like long movies, you know, and I like the idea of a series being a long movie. We just finished the first season of The Bear. We're behind on that, the Hulu show. But another great one. It really just plays like a long ass film. And as someone from the theater who has the patience to hear a 3 or 4 hour story, I love binging like 4 episodes of half hour drama where those exist. Because that's another thing that I hope climbs up, and that's why I like The Bear. Half hour drama, man, we can do
it. But how do you leverage that with the level that we are at now as creators? Well, you're creating like a long running work of like a long running like talk show, but how do you leverage that with people who want to be creators, like a generation of people who are empowered by technology but in a lot of ways less empowered? How do you leverage everyone wanting to like make these massive long sprawling shows, but really, in terms of resources, your best chance is making something really small. No one likes small things anymore.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying. And I think there's a couple of things there, right? I think we accept that the big things are to be worked towards. They don't have to be all of media.
Yeah.
I think I would love to see, and I don't know how this happens. I think it would have to happen on a streaming platform that starts taking chances with this, which is, and you would probably have to start, you really would have to start with almost a, who's the guy that does American Horror Story?
Ryan Murphy.
Ryan Murphy. You would almost have to start with kind of an anthological kind of Ryan Murphy approach to mm-hmm. it. But I would love to see more shorts. Tell me a whole fucking story in 15
everyone
minutes.
Everyone gets started. Yeah. That's the and thing. People are like, oh, I don't want to make a short film. Like, what?
But you have to, you have to create the appetite for that by,
yeah.
by making and showing great ones that are not made by amateurs.
Yeah.
So you need,
that's why they show us first semester of the first year of school, UNCSA, a class just on short films.
Right.
And you watch like weird, strange, horrifying short films from like Poland from like,
yeah.
like the 80s, and you're like, what the fuck?
And well, it's and really, they still yeah. they still get made, but because no one wants to spend the money on distribution for short films, mm-hmm. because they're worried, you're, well, what do I watch now? That only took 20 minutes. And they go, now what do I do with my time? Or 40 minutes, whatever. But they're, one of my favorite films ever is, have you ever seen Six Shooter, Martin McDonagh?
Yeah.
With, yeah.
yeah.
So, which is really kind of the precursor to all the movies he's made with Brendan Gleeson and Colin yeah. Farrell and stuff. And it's a short and it's weird. And I don't normally like shit like that. I'm very mainstream in my sensibilities and aesthetics. I like the normal down the aisle kind of stuff with a dry sense of humor. That's enough for me. It doesn't have to be weird. It doesn't yeah. have to be special. If it does, I kind of get pulled back. But that, I still think about that fucking movie all the time. And the only reason I watched it was because some other nerd gave it to me. Not because it was
yeah.
showing somewhere or on a platform, or I couldn't get yeah. to it. It was a fucking QuickTime file, man. I watched it on a laptop because someone was like giving it to me like a fucking VHS tape yeah. in the 90s. I'm like, you gotta check this out. And I got to watch it because someone gave it to me. But I don't think we... Here's the problem with the shorts. Where do the ads play? And if you can't figure that out because there's no act break, or it's not long enough to sell like a film that you're going to sit down and really take your evening and take your date to, how do we sell it? What is the value other than it's great?
I mean, short form content is like, they tried it with Quibi. That
right?
didn't go well.
Right?
That didn't go very well at all.
It's like there's we can't find a difference between 40 minutes and 60 seconds.
That didn't go. Yeah, trying to get different short streaming platforms off the ground hasn't gone well.
It's got to live in the big boys.
TikTok is short content, but it's...
YouTube is the closest thing we have.
YouTube's great.
YouTube is great.
All the time.
I have YouTube Premium, man. I pay for YouTube Premium. I don't even give a fuck. Yeah. They just raised the price. I was pissed. I'm still paying for it. I'm not watching ads. I watch YouTube all the time. I think that's our closest thing, you know, and they had Red and they had Premium. They've tried to do their own little original content stuff. But I really do think, dude, I think if there's ever going to be an appetite, a hunger, and a world where shorts, which are the easier thing to make and to learn on, really have an audience, they got to find, the big boys got to find a way to, on max, when you turn yeah. it on, it's like new season of Sex and the City. Fucking here's this TLC thing we added from Discovery. Here's a movie and here's a series of shorts that are made by huge names and they're starring huge names. So you're yeah. going to give them a chance even
that.
Though they're a new format.
They
you're
going
to try them out.
With like the Antonio Banderas, Pedro Pascal, gay cowboy movie that Almodovar directed.
That oh, I didn't
like
see that. That sounds great.
And I think Almodovar also did The Human Voice with Tilda Swinton. It was a big like, he'll go out of the way to do stuff at Cannes. David Lynch got a short film. They about a monkey on Netflix.
Oh,
this
man.
This was a while ago, but okay. he just made a short film with a monkey on Netflix. It's like 5 minutes long a while ago because some of them have to be 5 minutes long. I agree that's like, I'm of two minds. It's like what I like to consume and what I like to, or what I can create. And I think I also like to consume Wagnerian epics and, you know, 7.5 hour. I read Matthew Lopez, The Inheritance on a car ride recently. It's like 7.5 hour long play in which he's got 80 characters. Like it's great. And I like to consume stuff like that. And I also like to read short articles that are just like a really beautiful, well-written essay.
Yeah.
And in terms of what I can do right now though, it's going to be short work.
Right.
Like, in terms of what I can do. And I am trying to, yeah, but I'm pretty cool with that. I'm pretty cool being like, that's my, I think that's my most Gen Z trait, is that I am creating things that are very short and work for a short attention span, particularly in writing, like doing like shorter essays that pack a punch or
well, and you're at that point in your life and in your age where, to answer the question again that you brought up, which is like, how do you leverage that? How do you reconcile that everything is super long and big, and then you got all these kids who want to learn? But that's what, like we said, that's what mentorship is supposed to be for.
Yeah.
You go to work and pay your bills cleaning up the paint buckets. Yeah. And then you go home and you sketch in your book. And those sketches don't end up on the walls of the museum yet. That's okay. But you're learning at work, and then you're going home and doing your little projects, and you just keep doing that until one day you go to your boss who's been mentoring you and it's like, man, you're crushing it, Charlie. You've learned so much. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of you. And you go, I'm glad to hear you say that. I have the script. It's done. I've got 15 grand. I need this. I need that. I'd like to do it. How can you help me? And then when you have all of that kind of in your hands, someone who has seen that when you're given something, you don't fuck it up all the time, that's when it gets happened. That's when it gets made. That's when it happens. That's when it all kind of, and then once you make the one short thing, the next thing you make is a little longer, or you make two, or you make a full length feature, or you make the pilot. I mean, I just finished a pilot that I'm really pleased with. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to shoot it this year. I've been saying that for 4 months, and I just recently decided I want to write this season. Mm-hmm. Before I even shoot the pilot, because I'm not in a hurry and I want to get the pilot right. And I would rather write 6 episodes and then come back and make sure that the first one is what I want it to be, and setting that stuff up so that whether or not I ever sell the pilot, I know that if I can find the resources, I can make the whole fucking thing. The whole thing. And then it'll be done. And then once you have a done thing, however you accomplish that, you're in a different sport. You've left the ball game, and now you're doing something else, which is like, you can self-publish and try to get everyone's attention first. You can shop around a whole done thing. They might tell you, this is awesome, we love it, but we're going to pay you to reshoot the whole fucking thing. That happens. You can just use the pilot to get the job.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, like, I'm also just like also of the mind of you. I'm like always thinking about like, how can I do this? How can I fit this? How can I make this work in this new digital age? But I'm also of the mind that I'm like, things come and go, and places and forms come and go as forms that are like, what's going to work. Like you're describing to me right now, the idea of a web series, which like when I was in high school, the 2000s web series were like YouTube web series. You were watching those YouTube web series.
Yeah, 100%. Now,
I think high school teens actually do still watch a lot of web series. And like, I know a lot of people who are like, yeah, you can leverage an amazing YouTube career off like a successful web series. Like that's still totally a thing. But I'm literally like in my mind right now thinking of like all my favorite web series. Like I'm getting flashbacks from like all these ones, like The Prettiest Girls in School, The Most Popular Girl in School, which is one with Barbie dolls where they're like acting out Barbie dolls. It was just some people like making that or,
There's Workaholics, Broad City. I mean, people have built totally mainstream careers off of it.
People who were, they were totally people from like outside backgrounds who like found this web
series. Bo Burnham's whole career was built on YouTube.
Coming about, it's brilliant. And then I think that was really embraced much in the way that, you know, in LA that was being embraced, right? The YouTube, go for it, via YouTube, like
they
film,
built their
something happened.
Studios.
And then they did YouTube and that was amazing. It's going to be something different now and it's not looking the same, but I also think back in, you know, New York in 2012 and Brooklyn and whatnot, it was the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. You could make a money being a blogger. You could make, that's how Mindy Kaling got started.
That's right.
That's how Gia Tolentino, who now like writes on BJ Novak's show.
Perez Hilton was the big thing when I was
all,
a kid.
Yeah. Like you could make a money being a blogger. They had the blogosphere and then it was all shut down by like the Hulk Hogan lawsuit and they like shut down. Like, yeah, but it was crazy to me that like, just 10 years ago, there were people in offices in New York City who created an ecosystem of the free press called the blogosphere. And it was, you know, not just like The Cut, but The Toast, but the, you know, Jezebel and Gawker and all that stuff. Like they created that and just as quickly it went away.
Right.
And I do think that Yeah, I don't know. It's scary.
Yeah,
it's,
but you know what doesn't change or go away? What doesn't change or go away, Charlie, is the skill set of the storytelling.
Right.
Because like, if you have a story about a family that opens a restaurant and you get cameras and you get lights and you get microphones and you shoot and you have a script and you get actors and you shoot the thing and they run the restaurant and then it opens and then it closes and then end and then credits and you make it. You can, it may not easily translate because it depends on how you do it, but that can get cut into something shorter. It could get drawn out into something longer. It could get cut into tiny 1 minute episodes. It could, I mean, there's so many things you can do with it once you make it. And I think the practice of the making is the way harder skill set to build. The adapting to how should we cut this into a thing that people will watch is a new evolving kind of confusing thing.
Yeah.
But I think we can roll with that as long as you keep the skill set of knowing how to make the thing, like what, how to tell an engaging story hasn't changed since Greek fucking theater. It's just the same. People get confused. People get excited when you tell them something might happen soon and they lean forward waiting for it to take place. You know, when the knife is on the edge of the counter going like this, we're on the edge of our seats waiting for the knife to fall. It's human nature.
Yeah. And that's what I think to all you people who are like maybe younger than me at UNCSA, I think, and people who are in the UNCS sphere, I want to say is that the technology is going to change exactly, but it's the principles.
Correct.
Like I had a cinematography student tell me one time at UNCSA, they were like, the Arri Alexa and the Red camera, which is what is our basically our God right now,
right,
the cinematography program will go away.
Yeah.
There will be a new thing. What matters is the principles, lighting, composition, contrast, shadows. Those are, so.
And you're going to get on set and they're going to be like, we have Sonys. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, even if they're not away, they may not be the thing that you get. And I think it's universal. That's why also when I went from having a degree in like directing theater and then trying to end the world of television.
The proscenium is the screen. It's the camera frame.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And you, the hardest part is this. And this is what I always tell younger people because I feel like they get a little lied to about it. And when I say younger, I mean younger than you. It does translate. The skills do translate. No one will ever give you credit for that. They will not agree with you that that is the case. You can take a lifetime of theater and go make films and you do need to learn some new shit, but it translates a lot of it. You can go make other things that are very similar. You can go from being good at drama in high school and then taking that into public speaking and it translates. But when the people hiring you for those gigs look at your thing and it doesn't say the thing they do right now, it says some other thing, even if it translates, they don't give a fuck. They're probably not going to give you credit for it. They're not going to go, oh, well, you did theater, so you're ready to work on this TV show. They're going to go, oh, you've never worked on a TV show. I don't know. And unless you really impress them on a personal level or they're your cousin or something, it is hard to convince people that your shit will transfer like that, which is bonkers. Because if you get them at a fucking barbecue and sit down next to them and you're like, get to know them and talk about your history in theater, they're gonna be like, oh shit, well, yeah, I mean, you could definitely do what I do. It's not that different. But I tell you, and I just recently mentioned this, this is the example I give. When I got out to LA, I started working in reality TV. I specifically started in like a surgery show and I worked on Housewives. And then I got into competition reality. So I was working on like, So You Think You Dance, Dancing with the Stars, other competition shows, Amazing Race. I was working on shows where the whole point of the reality is they're in a competition. I was in between jobs and I was trying to get a job on two different, because they were exploding at the time, competition cooking shows.
Yep.
And I was like, it's not the cha-cha. It's not the salsa. It is salsa. Like, it's not that different. It's, but it's, hey, how are you doing? Are you having trouble? Like, producing is the same thing. And I'm thinking, yeah, easy. They're going to be like, oh, he's qualified for sure. Every single one of those cooking shows had a line that was on the posting or on the list, or they said it in an email, must have prior competitive cooking reality experience.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And I've faced it one time or another. And I will tell you that I know people who worked on those shows. That's how I got the hookup to go talk to them. And they were like, I don't know why they do that.
I don't know why they do. I say that as a person who does film, like, goes from film thing to TV thing to video games thing to that. Like, I don't know. They say stuff like that. But like, really, like, if you have like the skills, exactly, you shouldn't have a hard time.
I think they're concerned about onboarding and they're trying to smooth that out as much as possible. But I don't know, man. And you tell me in 10 years when you've had like more experiences with different people in these dynamics of you, I would rather have someone who has less experience in the hyper-focused area that I'm hiring them for.
Yeah, we shouldn't. It's weird to live in a world of where people are that specialized.
I well, feel like that, and I'm like,
continue to be more general.
Yeah, I would like you to be general, post and college, I want to teach you the specialty. Yeah. So, like, if you've been a waiter, but we work at like a snooty steak place,
right?
I would rather hire you as like a waiter who's been a waiter for 8 years at normal restaurants and teach you how to be snooty at the steak place, rather than get you from another snooty steak place and you don't do it the way I'd like you to do it.
This is so funny because this exact drama about like hiring chefs and how that chef works under a mentor in a chef room was actually drama that was playing out in a cooking competition reality show that I worked on. Because here's the thing about cooking competition reality shows. It's just theater.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, over the top, with an audience orchestrated, manufactured theater. It's literally like a play.
I think I've finally... If you're
in the sound stages where they're doing it, it's so like over the top and like performative. It literally feels like when you are on the set of a reality cooking competition TV show in a Burbank warehouse. Yeah. Actually, they do them in abandoned malls.
Yeah.
It feels exactly the same way you feel at the Black Box Theater at UNCSA.
At Catawba. Yeah, 100%.
That intimacy and the audience and the energy.
So here's
and the
how
chefs
I put
are like
it.
Playing up their personas.
100%.
It's so, the artifice.
This is how I put it. Reality TV is an improvised soap opera where real people play themselves. That's what it is. And when you add the cooking element, the competition and the audience there, it becomes that. In a theater.
Mm-hmm.
It is dramatized. It is a soap opera. Every single reality TV show must be entertaining.
Yeah.
That is the point
of
it.
In a lot of ways, what we're talking about.
It's not
about
a documentary.
Peak TV really kind of getting, not that there's not so much good TV, but peak TV kind of, it seems like we're going to shift away from the model of there being 300 scripted TV. I mean, do you agree we're probably going to move away from a place of there being 300 scripted TV shows on air that we're probably going to like go to there being less of these shows with the writer's strike?
No, I don't think that's right.
Because I think my theory with it is, well, the thing is there's so many of these shows, Rob, but they cancel them after one season.
Right.
So of those 300 shows, very few of them are like Ted Lasso or something like
that. Yeah, and I think they'll keep doing that. I think they'll keep making 300, 400, 500 shows and they'll have even shorter lifespans and the big ones will go on
and
the little
ones
will die.
But I think what is going a long time is reality TV. And I don't think it's because reality TV is great necessarily.
Well, it's because it's cheap to
make. Of course. But reality TV provides people with what a lot of television, a lot of the stuff we're describing, these long form podcasts, like, well, podcasts, I think, also usurp TV because all these things have structure.
Mm-hmm.
They have a really tight episodic structure where you know exactly what's going to happen at the end of the episode. They're all going to get around the tiki torch and someone's going to get
let go. Comfortable and predictable in a way.
In the podcast, this podcast is different, but I listen to a lot of very structured podcasts where they're like, we're going to do this segment.
We're going to do this
ad break. People like the structure. They like the predictability. They don't like,
Yeah, I think you're right, but I don't think... I think the reason that, and anyone who doesn't know this is, they come off as patronizing to you, but I know you already know it. I'm going to say it to everyone who doesn't know. Reality TV only exists as a response to the cost of scripted television. The only reason that it ever showed up, starting with like Real World and all that, and then blowing up with Big Brother and all the other shows. And
it's a big fuck you to SAG.
Yeah, it's a big fuck you to SAG. It's a big fuck you to WGA. It's a big fuck you to IATSE and everybody, even though they employ a lot of union people.
The idea
was we are going to spend all this money to invest in a scripted TV show, and it may not be good. And then if it's not good, we have to start all over. We have to make that investment again. The idea was, and it's a completely sound business decision, which is like, okay, well, how can we make the upfront cost of trying out a new show lower so that if it fails, it doesn't cost us as much money? And the easy answer is, well, get people who aren't actors, because you don't have to pay people who aren't in the union, but also just non-actors are willing to take less money to be on TV as themselves than someone playing a part, because they see benefit to that attention and stuff like that. So you capitalize on the fact that they like being on TV and you get to pay them less money. And you shoot it on cheaper cameras. Mm. There's a million different things that are just lower cost to make it. That gives you way more chances to throw something at the wall and see if it sticks, which is why there's like a giant graveyard of dead reality shows that had like 3 episodes, because they tried it, but didn't work. They scrapped it, didn't cost them that much. They write it off, they move on, they do another. With the changing of the size of the writers' rooms, and a lot of things will depend on how the WGA contracts shake out, the issue that we've been having lately, and I think this is what you're touching on, 300 shows, is they've shrunk the size of the writers' room. So where now they're written by one person or 3 or 5 people at most, which frees all the writers up to go make other shows in a way. But more than anything, it limits the flagship, let's all have this as a steady job for a long time gig of I'm going to work on Friends for 10 years. Like, those kind of things don't show up as much. Those gravy trains, you know, don't really exist, which is also okay. But I feel like the structure of reality TV only allows for so many opportunities. And I think that if reality TV and unscripted stuff was as powerful as some people are afraid it is, we would have almost no scripted shows left. They would never make Game of Thrones. They would never make these multi-million dollar scripted TV shows, because they just wouldn't be worth the return. Like, why would we do that when we can do another season of Housewives?
That's why the streaming bubble's contracting.
A little bit, but that's what I'm saying is I think that there's a difference between Game of Thrones and Barry. There are shows that you can do, The Bear. There are shows that you can make that are great, that are powerful, that tell good stories, that are employing actors and writers.
Do you go to film festivals?
Very few. Very few. Yeah. And mostly because I have found that the smaller ones, it is hard for me to keep my attention.
Yeah,
like amateur film festivals are hard.
River
for me.
Run in North Carolina is pretty good.
The bigger ones I've just never ventured to go to.
At some point, I tried. Yeah, so I've been to River Run.
I'm from Austin. I've never been to South by Southwest.
I heard that's a really good one in the AFF.
I've heard that too. I've never been able to afford it.
I went to Sundance because UNCSA sent me there, and it was a really great experience, because I think all this stuff you're talking about right now, like just seeing the young talent, seeing people who, and a lot, you know, some people get picked up by an agent while they're there, some people, but like seeing a young talent who made something you could have made that's really genius, that does everything with a lot of limitations, like all that's there all the time.
Right.
And I do see why people become these, like my friends who are critics become, like they get into like festival world and stuff like that. I do see why it's so exciting
to people,
because I've been, because it's exactly what you're seeing. It's like, it's a space, and it's also a space where, you're just seeing a lot of people. Maybe it's like a theater festival. I haven't actually been to a theater festival outside of just seeing a lot of plays at UNCSA. Like, it's just like, I could have done that. Yeah. I could have done what that person did.
Yes.
And maybe that's why describing all this stuff, it becomes a bit alienating to me, all these shows and stuff, because it's almost more exciting for me to watch films and see stuff that people have done that I'm like, I could have done that with my friends in Echo Park, you know?
Right. But that will change as what you feel like you're capable of grows.
Yeah.
So when I watch a show like The Bear or Barry, it doesn't feel a million miles away from making it. Mm-hmm. When I write a pilot, I see it like that. And I think when I make it, it's going to look like that.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be that good. I'm okay with that. But you have to in your 20s, man. You have to have this kind of do it on a shoestring idea, because that is how you get to accomplishing the first few projects that really make you feel like, I know what I'm doing. The next one I want to be like this. This is how it should change. Mm-hmm. Like, you get those under your belt and it changes what you feel like you can do. And also the people that you're around. You know, when I first left school, I was like, you know, when I first did the podcast, great example. When I first did this podcast, the only people I could get to talk to me were my friends. So I just talked to my other friends mm-hmm. who graduated 20 minutes mm-hmm. ago. They had no stories because we all are like, haven't been out of school and everything. But we started with that. And now over time, it's a completely different experience because I talked to people who graduated in the 80s. I talked to people who graduated very recently. And it changes as you get more context. You know, I started working on Dancing with the Stars. I did like 6 seasons with them, and whether they were new or old or young or whatever,
oh, wow.
I met so fucking many celebrities, and that kind of also became, I worked on a couple other like celebrity competition things.
I
met so many fucking celebrities, dude. And I met some growing up, and I was never a big like starstruck guy, but like I've at this point, it doesn't feel like it's way over there.
No, I see.
You know what I mean? It feels more accessible and like.
I know. And I know people diss it, but like, I do kind of love the star spotting aspect of LA a lot still.
Fuck
like,
yeah,
it's still
dude.
Very funny. Like, oh, hey, like, you know,
it
like,
feels like we're
fun.
All here together doing
fun,
the thing.
You know?
And I know that people have all sorts of mixed feelings about this. And I'm going to be, I would tear this conversation to shreds if I could. We've got to have wrap up, but I want to make this point. I never felt the thing.
I have a question
about,
too.
Okay, hold it for 1 second.
Yeah, of course.
I never felt the thing about New York that a lot of kids at School of the Arts, especially in drama, were like, oh my God, Broadway, New York, can't wait, New York, New York, New York. I'd already lived there in high school. I've lived there a few times. It
did
doesn't work
to,
for me.
Did you go to LaGuardia?
No, I went to Talent Unlimited, different high school. Mm-hmm. But I've never had that passion for it. Even when I was a kid and I moved there the first time, I wasn't like, wow. I was like, this is cool. I felt that way about LA my whole life. Hollywood. I'm like, I'm overly fetishized it for a really long time. Not just the city, but the notion that all these things I've been watching my whole life that I love so much were made right there and right there and right there. And to this day, I don't really get over it. I've been on the Warner Brothers tour like 4 times. Like it.
Yeah.
I like Hollywood. I like the history of film and cinema and mostly TV. I'll be more specific. I'm really a TV nerd.
Okay.
And for me, I never get over, you see some celebrity, I don't go, oh my God, it's fucking Matt Damon. I'm like, but you are like, I work near Matt Damon. Like he makes millions and millions and millions of people entertained. And there's so many people agree that he has value in certain ways. And I'm right over here in the same place trying to do a similar kind of thing that he's doing, which is make stuff that makes people happy. And even if I don't work next to him on a project, it feels like we're all here trying to make, and as much shit as we get for being LA and for making the things we make, the whole goddamn world runs, it feels like, on the culture we make in this city.
No, exactly.
It feels like you're a part of it.
I'm also from the South. I'm also from,
right.
I'm from Charlotte. I mean, it was just, this stuff was... People honestly actively disdained like life on the coasts.
Yeah,
they really thought it was like heathenistic. Some of them still do. So it's just,
and some of it is. That's also part of what's fun being here.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Let's be honest.
Oh my gosh. Yes. But
what was your question?
It's just cool. Exactly. It's like every day I'm like, oh, it's cool just to be here.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I don't really get over
going
it.
Going through it. Yeah. My question was, we both like Family Guy. You really
sure.
like TV. We just like ragged on a lot of like not so great TV. We talked about some prestige TV, but like what's like a thing that is almost unanimously considered by the world to be bad and trash? Could be reality. Could be something like Family Guy that you're like, no, actually really good. And you will like die on that hill.
That's a great question. It's a good podcast question.
Because to me, it's like Family Guy. Like when you mentioned that, I'm like, I will stand up and talk about how Family Guy and American Dad are like phenomenal TV shows.
I think only because it's the example you started with. I'm bummed because that probably would be one for me for sure. I still like, I'm not religious about watching it. I still do watch it and I still keep up with modern episodes. It's not universally panned because, when it was on, it was universally beloved, but now there's this huge movement in my generation and in yours to say that the show Friends is bad and has all these blind spots about culture too. They give it a lot of shit about being like homophobic and all these different things.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of that show. If you're sitting in this living room, you see the influences. It's not subtle. I'd have like a Friends themed wedding. I don't accept it as like a perfect show. by any means, but I will go to bat for it really fucking hard in a few categories. And I don't fight fights about art with people because I think, like I said, I don't, if you say something really ignorant about art, in my opinion, and just in my personal opinion, it sounds like you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I don't go out of my way to fight with you about it because I don't think you know what the fuck you're talking about. So I don't see the point in trying to get you to agree with me when you started somewhere else that I can't even relate to.
Right. You have to like learn to just like give it up. Just
but
drop it.
If we're in good faith having a conversation, one of the number one things I see about the show Friends that drives me crazy, and this is true about anything when people say this because it's so stupid, is it's not funny. And it drives me a little bit crazy in my brain anytime someone points to something that is comedy and marketable and successful and try to say it's not funny when what they mean is I don't find it funny, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to say. But it drives me crazy as someone who loves comedy and loves being funny and working on that stuff. And I write on a comedy show now. It's what I do. I take being funny maybe too seriously. And I don't want to get up my own ass about it. And truthfully, it's like, I always think about that South Park episode where Jimmy tries to make the comedy awards and everyone's like, the whole point of comedy is you can't take it seriously or it doesn't work. And I think that that's true, but I don't like people saying that things, comedians, shows, whatever. I don't like The Big Bang Theory. I did not enjoy it. A lot of people did. I can't say that show's not funny. Because it was a comedy and it made millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars every week. Like, and people watched it and they laughed and the audience went and they laughed. It is funny. It just doesn't work for you. And the thing that I would really go to bat for is I think the six people on Friends all in really different ways, and I still rewatch it to this day, all of their comedy technique is just fucking amazing. Like, they're really talented people in really different ways. I'm a big fan of that. Humor and that 90s sarcasm really is just a part of my sensibility. And I think that there will be a time when we, just like we do with kind of 80s humor, we look back and like, man, 90s humor is very, even now it's very specific. It's very sarcastic. It's very eye roll. Yeah. It's very under your breath. It's very dry. And I think it's so wild that show, which was like the number one show in America for a long time, now has this big wave of like, yeah, it always sucked. And I'm like, yeah, that's fundamentally you're flawed in your argument because they're the first TV show cast to make $1 million an episode. They weren't unsuccessful at making people laugh, dude. Mm-hmm. You don't get to say that. So I think that's one of them. Family Guy's definitely up there because I really just appreciate their sense of humor.
All these things you're describing have just amazing comic timing and amazing comic understanding of space, time, blocking, physical acting, physical comedy. It's not just that the writing was good on the page. All these things you're describing were masters of vaudevillian
comedian humor. Dane Cook. Mm-hmm. That's someone that to this day, it's hard to find someone who will stand up and say they were a fan. And yet he was the highest selling comedian in history at the time when he was popular. Mm-hmm. And people love to be like, he was always terrible, or he doesn't write real jokes, or it's all about jumping around and being silly and he doesn't have punchline, whatever your critique is. And that is a great example of like, I'll go to bat. You want to go line by line, I'll break down why he's funny and smart and I liked what he did.
Yeah.
And I think that's also just something I've always been willing to do. And I think it's important for young artists to have that sensibility. I've got a bunch of things in that I don't think fit the exact description you said, but I've always said like, I like things that people turn on and I stay with them. Like there was a while, and I don't know if you remember this at all. You would have been pretty young, but there was a while where Ben Affleck was a famous actor in America. He was a number one actor and everyone thought he was handsome and beautiful and talented.
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, everyone hated him. He was the worst actor in America. And he made his movie with Jennifer Lopez that people didn't like. And it was his relationship with her and everyone made it a big thing. Geely.
Okay.
Spelled G-I-G-L-L-I. They were both two of the biggest stars in America and they made a movie together and it was bad and it changed. He kind of fell off the map. He wasn't a big deal. People hated him.
But Rob, then he came back as a director. The trash that I like can also be, and this is a bit in the Seth MacFarlane thing, but this was also, you know, like Fashion Police and TMZ. But sometimes the trash I like people were kind of like able to be a little bit meaner towards, like, people were so mean. The culture was so mean. We were so mean. And it was like fashion police, like Joan Rivers, like,
I fucking love Joan Rivers valuable. So much.
Like, the meanness can't even be as good anymore. Like, the meanness was like,
when I grew up on that Joan Rivers, Don Rickles is one of my favorite comedians of all time, who made his entire career off of being mean to people and they right to their
just
face.
Just watch old Joan Rivers clips.
Watch Joan Rivers and Don Rickles and get an idea of how things have changed as far as people's personalities. Yeah. And I think more of that is, around the corner. I think we'll respond to that. We got to wrap up.
Trash? Dude. Oh, we'll find some trash, me and you. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll find it. Charlie, thank you for taking the time, man.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. And we'll have you back on soon.
Okay.
Thanks, dude.